Hello and welcome to DGT Radio, DGT's knowledge sharing podcast, exploring themes and topics that are relevant to our everyday work. So our topic today is international standards in translation, and more specifically ISO translation standards. This may sound a bit boring at first, but when you dive into the topic, you realize it's actually quite interesting. It's full of surprises and it's quite relevant to our work in DGT. So to help us explore this topic, I have invited our DGT colleague Ingemar Strandvik. So Ingemar, thank you for accepting our invitation.
Thank you for inviting me.
So Ingemar, you are one of the three quality managers in DGT, and you work on ISO translation standards on behalf of DGT, alongside experts from all over the world. So you'll tell us more about your work in a moment, but first, could you tell us what is ISO, the International Standard Organization? Because I must say, naively, I thought that it was the only international body for standardization in the whole world, just like the World Health Organization, for example. But in fact, there are other standardization organizations in the world alongside ISO that are sort of competing with ISO. And also, I thought ISO standards were free, but in fact, most of the time you have to buy them, and it's even quite expensive, and you have to pay just to access them and to read them, and they can cost over 100 euros. So could you explain to us in a few words, what is this strange organization ISO, and who are the other big players?
Well, there is indeed a number of standardization bodies in the world, at national level, at regional level, and at international level. The oldest national ones are the BSI, the British Standards Institutions, and the DIN, the Deutsche Institut für Normung, and also the American ANSI. These are more than 100 years old. And then you have regional ones like the European CEN. It's the French abbreviation, Commission Européenne de Normalisation, and the American ASTM. And so, as you said, at global level, ISO is the biggest international standardization body, but there are also ASTM International with a kind of American bias, and something called IEC, International Electrotechnical Commission, and IATA for civil aviation is also rather known, etc., etc. So, as you said, there are many of them, but for translation purposes, the relevant ones are ISO and also the American ASTM and some national standards bodies. For the future now, with everything that is happening on AI, there's also something called the GTC, the Joint Technical Committee, that might become relevant in the coming years. We can get back to that later if there is time. Just to reply to your question on ISO, ISO was created after the Second World War. It's a non-profit organization based in Switzerland, and over the years it has adopted and published more than 20,000 standards in basically all imaginable areas and all sorts of activities. And it's financed partly by the fees from selling standards. And that is why you have to pay and why it's rather expensive. But the terminology is accessible for free. And also the introduction part of all the standards. There's a website for that.
Okay, so now that we know what ISO is, could you say also in a few words, what is a standard and why standards are needed? On the ISO website, it says, think of them as a formula that describes the best way of doing something. How would you define standards?
Yeah, indeed. Standards are an agreed way of doing something, agreed by the experts of the activity concerned. So standards are typically created when the stakeholders of an activity consider that there is a need for agreeing on how to do something. Mm-hmm. So they can be seen, as you said, as a formalization of best practices, or as the distilled wisdom of the activity. Basically, standards do two things. They define key concepts of the activity concerned, so that the stakeholders know what they mean when they talk about different aspects of the activity, and they describe or prescribe workflow processes for how the standardized activity should be carried out. And thereby they clarify what the different stakeholders can expect from each other when interacting in their different roles in whatever activity or product or service we're talking about. So importantly, standards in this way can be seen as an additional layer of consumer protection, additional to government policies, legislation, or consumer protection organizations. Often standards end up in legislation or in contracts.
Could you give us a few examples of ISO standards?
As I said, there are tens of thousands. Most standards are process standards, outlining how to set up workflows or how to ensure that the resulting output, be it a product or a service, is of the desired quality. A basic quality management principle is that you can't inspect quality into a product, you build quality into the process, into the workflow. So maybe the most well-known standards are the quality management standards, ISO 9000, or the ones on risk management, project management, information security, on machinery, medical devices, construction materials, consumer goods, food products, I don't know, there's even, on snorkeling, for instance.
Okay.
I mean, anything, okay. You name it.
Yeah, I read that there is an ISO standard just to ensure that thermometers are calibrated in the same way in all hospitals.
Voilà.
And it has this really poetic name of ISO 86101.
They
all
exactly.
have these horrible names.
Exactly.
And how are standards adopted, in a few words?
Well, it's consensus building process that normally takes 36 months, so 3 years. This process consists of a handful of different stages where the working group members vote and comment on each stage. So at any stage, at the voting phase, if a majority of the experts is not in favor of the result, the project can be abandoned, which happens quite often. But if it is adopted, then standards are up for what is called a systematic review after 5 years. And after 5 years, the working group then votes on confirming the standard, updating the standard, or withdrawing the standard if it has become obsolete.
Now let's have a closer look at ISO's translation standards. So who are behind them? How many countries? What kind of experts?
National standards bodies normally have so-called mirror committees at national level, replicating the ISO committee structure for different working groups. And these mirror committees have a large representation of industry interests and sometimes also include some representatives from academia. And this is exactly what's happening in the field of translation. What is referred to as TC37SC5,
okay.
Working Group 1, meaning the Technical Committee 37, Subcommittee 5, and Working Group 1, which is the one that deals with translation standards. Well, in this working group, there are 38 active national standardization bodies and 19 so-called liaison members. And, liaison members are professional or political organizations, interest groups, etc., who can appoint experts to participate in the development of the standards. But they do not have voting rights as the national standardization bodies.
Okay.
So, for instance, the European Commission, the European Parliament, the European Court of Justice, or organizations like FIT, the International Federation of Translators, and they are liaison members. Some of the national bodies are more active than others, and some are more knowledgeable or more advanced than others. And from my experience in this working group on translation, the most high-profile delegations are the ones from the US, from Canada, from Argentina, and in Europe from Germany, Austria, Spain, UK, Ireland, and Poland.
Do you know why some countries are more active than others? In the case of Canada, I thought that maybe it was because they have two official languages, English and French.
Well, I don't know why some are more active than others. I think that rather than the number of national languages, I think it's a matter of the presence of the translation industry.
Mm.
Translation service providers They defend their interests and are interested in creating clarity for the industry. So, I mean, as I said before, standardization is very much an industry phenomenon. So the most active national delegations are really full of translation service providers of all sizes. I think that would make, I don't know if this is the reason, but I think so. It would make sense since miscommunication costs a lot of money. So they are all interested in agreeing on, you know, what to call things and how to work in an agreed way to create a level playing field.
Now, why are we, European Commission and also the European Parliament, etc., only liaison members?
ISO is composed of national standards bodies who together form ISO. And we are not a country. It's as simple as that. Mm. And as I said, international organizations of all kinds, instead, they have this liaison status. Mm-hmm. And we are so-called A liaison members, which means that we have all the rights and possibilities to interact as the national bodies, mm-hmm. except that we don't have voting rights. But from a practical point of view, it's not really a big deal because most of the work is done in the working group, and there we have the presence we want, so we can make our voice heard in the discussions in the working group. And in the ballots, in the votings, we can also provide written comments. So it doesn't really matter.
Okay. So what would you say is the most important translation standard? Is it the what is called the umbrella standard with the sweet name of ISO 1700?
Yes, indeed. It's the most important. I mean, there is a history behind. I think it's for at least some 25 years now. Now the industry has wanted to... desperately wanted to standardize translation. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So because of the very rapid growth of the translation industry during the last decades. Simplifying a bit, we could say that it started with a German standard in 98, I think, DIN 2345.
Okay.
And then in 2006, it was kind of, at the European level, there was an standard EN 15038.
Okay.
And then in 2015, this famous ISO 17100 replaced all the different regional and national standards that were in place already. And as you say, it is currently considered to be the umbrella standard for high-end translation service provision. So high-quality translation service provision. Mm-hmm. And it is, as I said before, it is a requirement standard. So there are hundreds, if not thousands, of translation service providers who are certified against this standard and who provide certified services, translation services, under this standard.
And what does this standard cover?
It defines the competence requirements of professional translators and revisers and reviewers. For instance, which is important for us, I think, is they really stress the key role of domain competence. I mean, the subject matter knowledge. You know, if you translate something about railway systems, technical stuff about railway systems, mm-hmm. if you don't have a clue about what it is about, you're not likely to be able to translate or revise or evaluate the text reliably. Mm-hmm. Or you will have to do it extremely slowly because you will have to double check everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one aspect. Another aspect is the definition of these different processes. You know, what is revision? It establishes the famous fitness for purpose principle, defining revision as examining the target text for its suitability for the intended purpose. Another definition issue is that the revision is done by a second person. It's the second pair of eyes principle, which is important. We have had discussions on this in DDT. You know, and also, you know, post-editing or revision, is it the same thing or not? Well, of course not, because it's not the second pair of eyes. Post-editing is the first pair of eyes, and so on. I think such things are very important. One thing that is particular with this standard is that it prescribes that all translations should be revised. So a kind of obligation with this two pair of eyes principle. And also this self-revision. It spells out that the translator, part of the translator's job is to go through the translation after having, you know, it's not just to go through the segments and off it goes. You should, as a translator, revise your own translation before you send, and that kind of stuff, which is interesting when you have a certified process. So if you buy this certified process, you know that the translation has been carried out in this way, following these different steps.
What does it say about machine translation?
Oh, It actually says the use of raw machine translation plus post editing is out of scope of the standard.
Okay, out of scope. So it says that basically we shouldn't use machine translation.
Yes, and of course this is not entirely in line with today's reality. It was adopted, the standard, in 2015. And at that time, so it was developed 2 years earlier, basically. And of course, in these 10 years, a lot of things have happened. So that feature of the standard is not really up to date.
And it will get revised, I guess.
In 2 years, it will be up for this systematic review.
Okay.
And that is definitely something that needs to be addressed. Because, machine translation today has nothing to do with what it was 10 years ago.
There is also a standard related to post-editing. Can you tell us a few words about this one?
Yes, this standard, ISO 18587, on post-editing of machine translation output, is also a requirements standard. It prescribes how to work with post-editing. From the workflow perspective, I would highlight two aspects of this standard. First, that it contains even stricter competence requirements for the post editors, mm-hmm, than ISO 17100. Often people think post editors do not need to be as competent as translators or revisers, but actually it's the other way around. According to the standard, they build on 17100 and then they have additional competence requirements for working with post editing. The second workflow step that I think is relevant is that in a compliant post editing workflow, the first step in the workflow is to determine whether the source language content is suitable for machine translation and post-editing or not. And if it's not, then you don't apply post.
Okay.
And this is important because the efficiency of the post-editing workflow depends, as we know, on the machine translation system, the language combination, the domain, and the quality requirements. We made fun of this exclusion of machine translation from 17100 as a flaw in that standard. There's a similar flaw or problem in this post-editing standard. The definition of post-editing is that post-editing is an editing process that can take place where all the text to be processed has been machine translated, or in an integrated environment where machine translation and translation memories, along with terminology management, are fully integrated to produce a multimodal translation work environment. Now, this is, of course, controversial because with such a definition, what we do in DGT is post-editing.
Mm-hmm.
And what we do is what most translators do today. So if this is called post-editing, then what is there left to be called translation? So I would argue, bear this in mind, when you hear that DGT's translators are change-resistant and reluctant to post-editing, what we do in DGT is post-editing.
Mm.
In the definition of this post-editing standard, it's just that interinstitutionally, we consider that this is how translation is carried out today, so we continue calling it the translation.
Yeah.
But this creates a lot of confusion.
So that needs revision as well,
this
aspect. So personally I see machine translation and translation memories as my personal assistants. They provide raw content on which I build my translations, and at best I can leave the sentence untouched, and at worst I just gain some typing time and I have to rephrase everything. So I think that's how most of us work nowadays, translators.
Exactly. And as you have heard, perhaps in different presentations of external experts we have organized during the last years, this is increasingly referred to as augmented translation. So the expert translators using all sorts of advanced or increasingly AI-based tools, but the human in the loop, so the translator being in charge.
To what extent are we in DGT complying with ISO standards, and do we need to apply them?
Well, first of all, we don't comply entirely. The position of DGT has always been that we don't need to comply. It would be red tape to go for certification, but we have also always said that we should use the standards for benchmarking and inspiration. We should be aware of what our profession prescribes, so that we know that we don't comply when we don't comply, and so that we make sure that we have good reasons for doing things in another way.
And would you say this applies to the fact that we have let go of the principle of 100% revision?
Yeah, that's a very good example, actually. The basic principle is clear, everybody agrees. The default should be full revision. Revision is the very key process for risk mitigation and sustainable quality assurance and data management over time, which is in particular very important in an institutional setting like ours. I mean, it's not a one-off translation. We have to ensure sustainability over time. But considering our specificities in repetitive texts, versions, normative memories, high match rates from authoritative reference documents, use of term bases, etc., we can safely cut on the revision requirement. And this is precisely why we have this system in place where revision is based on risk assessment. Of course, the challenge is to ensure that the risk assessment is carried out thoroughly and that we use a risk log, the famous tick box, when we are not able to carry out the quality control we think we need because of the risk assessment.
So you mean the tick box in Mandesk
says
that you haven't been able to revise the translation for lack of resources, lack of time, but that you think that it should have been revised thoroughly, yeah?
Exactly.
Okay, right. What other use can or should we make of the standards in DGT?
Standards are authoritative. You can't dismiss ISO standards the way you dismiss what individual translators might say. Common definitions definitely lead to better communication. If we implement these definitions and use them, it will improve the communication within DGT, across languages, and between language departments and managers, or in DGT's communication with external contractors, or in DGT's communication with the rest of the commission. For example, I mean, when we talk about what the evaluation or revision is the same thing or not.
Are there other ISO standards that can be useful to us apart from the translation standards?
An outside translation, there are several terminology standards that provide concrete guidance on how to work with terminology.
Mm-hmm.
Our colleagues in D1 are present in the terminology working groups, but these standards are definitely useful for how to work with terminology. Then there is this new plain language standards that was published just a couple of weeks ago. This is the first plain language standard ever. The adoption of these standards is likely to contribute to further strengthening the focus on clear writing. Our colleagues from S3 are in, editing unit, are in the ISO also active in this work.
Is the process of creating and adopting these standards, is it quick enough, given how fast technology is developing? And I'm thinking in particular now with the large language models like GPT-4.
No, of course it's not quick enough. The technology moves far too fast. So the challenge is, for the standardization work, the challenge is to standardize at a level where the tools development or the technological development doesn't make the standards obsolete immediately. And this is a problem that is not restricted to the translation. It's a problem that exists in most areas, which is precisely why there is this rule with what is called systematic review after a maximum of 5 years. So if the development is really fast, the review can be triggered before the 5 years. And this is, I should say a few words about, I hinted at this GTC, the Joint Technical Committee, which is relevant here. So the GTC, the Joint Technical Committee, is a cooperation between ISO and this IEC, the International Electrotechnical Commission, which deals with IT. And the GTC, this joint cooperation between ISO and IEC, now wants to create a joint working group with TC37, the Technical Committee 37 that deals with language. And this joint working group, if it's and when it is set up now, will become very relevant with regard to AI and the recent large language model and how to implement it efficiently and safely. And this GTC works on the basis of a proposal that comes from the European Commission.
Now, do the translation service providers DGT is working with, do they comply with ISO standards? Do they need to have an ISO certification?
I suppose most of them are certified and work with other clients as certified under these different standards. But we don't require that they are ISO certified. I mean, we could do that, but we consider that that would be red tape.
What is in the pipeline in terms of translation in ISO?
There's quite a lot of interesting things in the pipeline. This standard, I'm the project leader for the standard on translation project management, ISO 11669, and the standard on evaluation of translation output. These two standards are almost finalized. They are about to be adopted.
Mm-hmm.
And both these standards are directly relevant for DGT. So that is very interesting. The project management standard is interesting in that it puts a lot of strong focus on specifications, risk assessment, and communication as the key to successful translation service provision, and gives concrete guidance on communication, you know, how it should take place before, during, and after the actual translation work. This is relevant, for instance, in the context of EDGT,
mm-hmm.
to build on best practices in this area. The evaluation standard, ISO 5060, is actually ISO's third attempt to develop a standard on translation quality evaluation. Two earlier projects have failed, so during this three-year period, at some point there has not been enough agreement on the way the project was heading, and they have been abandoned. But this time, you know, this is the third time, and this time it will be adopted. Then, as I mentioned, the post-editing standard is up for revision. The revision process has just started. That is also highly relevant to clarify, you know, this idea. What is it, translation or is it post-editing? What's the difference? Is there any difference between post-editing and translation, or is it getting more and more blurred? This will be very interesting. And also the ISO 17100, because of this, as you pointed at, this exclusion of machine translation, doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
So that standard would be up for review in 2 years' time.
Okay.
So probably the post-editing standard and the work on that will lead to some changes that will be implemented in ISO 17100 as well. So it's the whole ecosystem of standards that is evolving, partly or perhaps even mainly because of the technological development.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it clearly will have an impact. Things are happening and things will come out of there. And as this GTC thing, the Joint Working Group on AI, I don't know yet because it hasn't been created. It will be created. But I imagine that it could be of interest to DGT to be there.
Mm-hmm.
Because we are kind of leading in AI in the commission, and it's also relevant for all our AI, exploration of AI-based tools for translation, and not the least for e-translation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot in the pipeline.
A lot in the pipeline. So that's what we should expect in the not-so-distant future. I think it's high time to wrap up. We could have gone on for ages, but I think we have to stop now.
Yeah.
So, Ingemar, thanks again for taking a bit of time to talk to us just before your well-deserved holidays, I think.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it was a great pleasure, and I wish you the best of luck for all these projects, and have a nice holiday.
Thank you so much.
This was DGT Radio with Ingemar Strandvik, Quality Manager in DGT. Thank you for listening.